In German, das ist der europäische Datenschutzbeauftragte. And that may be clear to some of you when you know that every EU member state has national data protection supervisors. In Germany, Germany is very good in that. Most countries have only one national data protection supervisor. Germany has 18 because it has the federal one, 16 national, and Bavaria has two, one for the public and one for the private sector. But the other 27 member states mostly have one, or some federal states also have several. So the all of these national supervisors are responsible for the public sector in their countries and for the private sector in their countries. And the European Data Protection Supervisor is responsible for supervising the processing of personal data at the EU institutions and bodies and authorities. The office was established in 2004 based on a regulation that was adopted 3 years earlier. And the two political members are elected for 5 years in turn. So we are close to the end of the second term, which will end in January. And the current holders are Peter Hastings, who is from the Netherlands and had this post from the very beginning, from 2004, and will be in office until January 2014. And he has already made it clear that he's not going to run for a third term, so that there will be change early next year. And the second post, which would be the deputy, or it's officially called the assistant supervisor, is currently Giovanni Buttarelli, former Secretary General of the Italian Data Protection Authorities. The DPS has three main tasks. One is the supervision and enforcement of the protection of the processing of personal data in the EU institutions. The second one, which is much more visible and also related to why I'm here today, that is in advising the European institutions, in particular the legislator, when they do new EU legislation that has an impact on the processing of personal data. And the third one is to ensure cooperation with all the other relevant authorities for data protection, so the national authorities, but also at international level, we cooperate with authorities in Asia, America, Canada, Pacific, and also, of course, in the areas of Europe which are not part of the EU yet. So, well, you see, nothing happens. Here we are. You won't see much. Maybe this is the organization chart of the EDPS, and you see myself here in this box. That is the sector for IT policy. So basically, my team is all IT and security experts, and we help all our colleagues to make sure that they get the technical parts right, because most of the others are lawyers and they are focused on doing things properly in the legal way. Yeah, for those of you on Twitter, I've put the hashtags on the thing. My own pseudonym was on the first slide. Just to explain a bit the context of data protection, or why do we have laws on the protection of personal data. Well, let me first say the American English or English expression privacy is more to the point, even though not completely, and the term data protection, which is derived from the German Datenschutz, is kind of putting a wrong emphasis, because it's not the data that's protected, but it's the people to whom this data belongs who are protected against negative impact on them through the processing of data. Luckily, in the long version of the names of the laws, this is correctly stated, because it's a directive and regulation and so on the protection of individuals with regard to the processing of personal data. So what's actually protected is the individual. So this slide shows a bit of developments with which you all are familiar. even though most of you may have started to join this discussion a bit further down the slides. Well, I was there already for the first bullet, obviously, and I do recall when computers in administrations and big companies appeared in the 1970s and when the first discussions in Germany took place on the risks connected to the extensive processing of personal data, which was extensive by the standards of the 1970s, which would be a joke by today's standard when we think that actually probably the computing power in my mobile devices now is more than that of many mainframes that were available in the 1970s. But at that time, you may recall that we had that there were homegrown terrorism problems in some European countries, in Europe, in Italy, in Germany, in the UK, of course, in Spain, and for different reasons. And that police in Germany in particular tried to develop new mechanisms by the use of computers. The president of the Federal Crime Office, BKA, Bundeskriminalamt, Horst Herold, was very ingenious in that. And they developed something which was called Rasterfahndung at the time. But you could call it filter investigation or scanning investigation, which was based on the idea of pulling together data from different companies and administrations like the inhabitants register, utility, customer databases from electricity, water, bank data probably, data about rental contracts and so on. And they had certain profiles to identify terrorists. For example, they had found that terrorists pay their bills in cash, they take short-term rental contracts, they live close to motorway exits, and they prefer big house apartments where neighbors are not very well known to each other. And so they collected all this data and then scanned through the data collected from different authorities to find people who matched these profiles. And then these people who had not any, there was no information of any criminal or terrorist activity related to the individuals, but just by having these profiles of totally normal, uncriminal attributes, they became suspects and would then be subject of further investigation. That was one example which rang the alarm bells with some people, and they thought we cannot have unlimited processing of personal data and give, in particular, the state unlimited power of spying on us or collecting data about us, and we need to do limitation. And so in that time, we had the discussion about the first data protection laws. Well, 80s, we had the advent of the internet and PCs, the web in the 90s, and I mean, you know how it went on, so I guess I don't need to go into too much detail on that. And now we are facing a new wave where big data is the keyword, which is basically more than anyone in the 1970s could ever dream of, to take all kinds of structured and unstructured, of formerly unstructured data to do it. And we have location tagged to everything, so we don't only know, we know not only what people have been doing, but where they have been doing it and every movement and everything. Okay, this is just the parallelism. It's of legal and technical development. I mentioned the 1970s, and actually the Landesdatenschutzgesetz Hessen was, according to most historians, the first data protection law ever. 1974 was the US federal data protection law, and interestingly, I didn't know that, but I heard it last week, that actually that was also a reaction on the problems they had with US President Nixon, who had his own spying program and was recording things and stuff, so they got conscious. In 1978, we had the first spam mail and national laws in France and Germany as well. And then 1980s, countries started to recognize that everyone creating a national law made it difficult because all these laws agreed on one thing: data must not cross borders, because it's very easy to have the, even then, the, to have your data center outside the country which has a strong data protection law, and once the data is gone from the country, there's no supervision, no legal power anymore to do anything. So all these laws said, well, first thing is you keep the data here and you process it here where we can see what you're doing. And of course that meant that it was difficult for companies who were just operating in many states from one central place to get the data there, because they were legally obliged to keep it in the country of origin. And so then in the OECD, that's the Organization of the Industrialized Countries, they started to work on principles how exchange of data between the different countries could be organized without this, and to create common agreements on the level of data protection so that could be done. Okay, yeah, well, that is about the start of the internet. That's some early browsers from CERN at the time. Okay, and here we have EU level, 95, the EU countries, which were 12 at the time, agreed on a common rules for data protection within the EU, and with that, the free flow of data between all EU member states was allowed, and there were no limits anymore. In 2000, the EU adopted a Charter of Fundamental Rights, where privacy and data protection became fundamental rights for all European. 2001 was the EU regulation for the EDPS, and so on. And 2006, we had an instrument which goes a bit in the other direction, which limits data protection and privacy by forcing telecommunication service providers to keep all records of all communications for somewhere between 6 and 2 months, according to the national rules. And in 2010, there was another famous agreement, which is called the Terroristing Finance Tracking Program, which is a US program, and this is also known under the term SWIFT, because that's the company that's providing the US Treasury with data to track. It's of course not exactly a data protection agreement. Okay, well, I think you're all pretty aware of the technical issues. I've already mentioned location-based service, and as you see here, these are all some cases that actually happened. We have investigations on Facebook, which promised certain privacy features to their users but did something else. We have all the time cases about the data collection of search engines. BT had a deep packet inspection system installed some years ago, where each and every packet was inspected for advertising purposes. Apple got some heat for the location tracking that the iPhone and the other iDevices do. A famous story is the customer profiling of the Target supermarkets in the US. Anyone familiar with that? The story goes that one day an angry man comes into a Target supermarket and says he wants to see the manager, and the manager comes, and then he pulls out some mailings, advertisement mailings from his packet, and says, "Why do you send my daughter stuff about newborn children? Do you want to inspire her to become pregnant or what? She's only 16. It's a bit early for that." And then the manager said, "Sorry, I mean, we have no such plans. What we actually do is when you have a loyalty card, we watch your purchasing behavior, and then from certain patterns in purchasing, we conclude about certain properties of the individual so that we can make best offers. And according to our program, your daughter must be pregnant about 6 months or so, and so we start sending her stuff that she will need when the baby is born." And then I said, "What? You must be crazy." And then he went home. And 2 days later, he came back and said, "Well, yeah, sorry, have to apologize. You were right. I didn't know. my daughter is actually pregnant. And that's just to illustrate the power of profiling and how fine-grained these automatic calculation and profiling systems are actually at this moment. Well, when I made these slides, I had not yet, I didn't update it, otherwise with cloud computing I would have just added in brackets Prism, and I think that says it all, and the question of foreign transfers. And here's one example of a data breach. The Sony case was particular pathologic because they actually had lots of personal data, also sensitive ones like credit cards and stuff stored on a server that was accessible through the web. Okay, so I skipped that. Yeah, we have this ongoing discussion about cookies and scripts and all this web tracking. Data protection authorities, for example, investigated Facebook on the basis of a complaint from Austria. There's a group which calls itself Europe versus Facebook. The Max Schrems, Austrian law student, is the main protagonist of that. And he complained at the Irish Data Protection Authority because Facebook says our basis for Europe and everything but the US is Ireland. And about 22, and I think in the end it was like more than 30 complaints about things where Facebook breached either the law or did something different from what they promised. And the Irish Data Protection Authority had to investigated that, and they came up with 12 recommendations. This case resulted inter alia in that facial recognition was turned off for Europe by default in Facebook. It's still turned on in the US, but in Europe by default it's not automatically that all your friends are recognized in your photos. And this investigation is still ongoing. There is more to happen this year. Okay, and there's an ongoing investigation against Google where several national authorities work together because of their changed privacy policy, which basically says whatever data we get from any of our services, we can use it for whatever we want for. And if you use our services, you agree to that. So now back to EU law. I mentioned we have two fundamental rights, which is like really very basic, the right to privacy, which already existed in the European Convention on Human Rights, which is a broader and older instrument, in the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights. It's also the respect of communications, which is the secrecy of communication. It's quite important, and the right to the protection of personal data. And here we have two elements, the fair and lawful processing. It must always have a legitimate base, and still everyone whose data is processed has the right of access to this data and the right to have it rectified if it's wrong. And there must be control by an independent authority. Okay, I have already mentioned this. The EU instrument had two objectives. One was to have a common, generally acceptable level of data protection, and the other one on this basis to allow data to circulate freely in the EU. The definition of personal data, and I leave that out. I hope you are familiar with that. I move on a bit to the EU data protection reform. So we have the 95 directive. And in January last year, the EU adopted, the European Commission made a proposal for a new instrument, two new instruments actually, one regulation, which is like a law that would replace the directive. But unlike a directive, a regulation is directly applicable in all member states. For a directive, the EU, once they have adopted the directive, they said it's basically sent to the national parliaments, who then have to adopt national laws which are in line with what has been agreed between the member states and with the European Parliament. While a regulation, the member states, governments and the European Parliament directly agree on the final rules, and these final rules are then directly applicable without going through a national transposition process, as that is called. So that was in 2012, and there has been a long preparatory process starting with a public consultation in May 2009. And what's currently ongoing is the so-called co-decision process, that is the European Parliament and the Council together. First, each of them for themselves have to come up with a view, and then they have to agree on something. So why was this launched, or what were the arguments to launch it? One was that with globalization, data flows and international interconnection was much stronger, and that the instruments for international data transfers were complex and overrun by reality in some cases, meaning not that data flows just happened illegally, but that there were new legal ways already in practice which were not yet fully covered by the law. So that was implemented. Then, of course, technological issues, the change quite fast, and then changes in the legal structure of the European Union with the Lisbon Treaty and the Charter, and that the framework at the EU was not really comprehensively covering all areas of EU legal competence. So the new instrument should have a more full coverage. And so many issues were not really laid down in the law, but discussed between people or companies and sorted out in practice, but there was no 100% certainty of if that's the right thing, because it wasn't really in the law and there was no final court decision, so that there was a certain degree of uncertainty, and there was an idea to lay down some new rules to make things clearer. And the main issue was also the new rules which brought the police and judicial cooperation between member states also in the general framework of EU policies and competences. The instrument consisted of three elements. For some reason, the third one is about here. So you can see it. The first one was a communication just explaining what was happening. Then this regulation that I already mentioned, which would be for the general public sector and for the private sector. And the third one would be a directive for police and justice. And the third one was a directive, so an instrument which has to go through national scrutiny and transposition, mainly for the reason that the power of the member states in this area is so strong that it would have been absolutely difficult, imaginable that they could ever agree on something at EU level. So it was the idea to leave more margin to member states in that area. So the EDPS also gave a view on this whole process, and the general idea that we had was that many of the elements of the new regulation would be a big step forward, but it would still not be as comprehensive as was needed and as good as what needed. There is more harmonization. There is theoretically, in the way it was proposed, a strengthening of the position and the rights of the data subject, more responsibility for the data controller, that is those organizations that are processing the data, and also strengthening of the DPAs, which is the data protection authorities, which may not be that necessary in Germany, but there are other member states where DPAs are pretty weak, where they have a few rights on inspection, like they cannot easily get access to the premises of suspected violators, and also have very little sanction possibilities. They cannot issue fines and so on, and this kind of things. And often, of course, the fines are very low. I mean, a fine of maximum a few hundred thousand euros for a company that makes profit of a few millions every hour isn't really a tough sanction. And so there's a lot of technical elements, and I can make available a PDF of this presentation, but it's also all available on our website. Two issues have drawn particular attention in the discussion, but often this is more like what in English is called a red herring. So that is something where a lot of steam is produced in the discussion, which is far beyond what is justified by the subject matter itself. So one thing which gets a lot of opposition from a particular American lobbyists, maybe, is what's called the right to be forgotten. Originally, the term is a French idea, the droit à l'oubli, and it basically means that when there is no reason to keep your data any longer, then it has to be deleted, erased. And it has an extension. This is nothing new. That has been a law already since there are data protection laws. You are only allowed to keep personal data of someone when you have a good reason for that. And when the reason is gone, you shouldn't keep it any longer. And here, this is written also with social networking services in mind, where it says when I delete my Facebook account and when I want this to be cancelled, then it should actually be cancelled indeed. And they shouldn't keep the data for their own purposes any longer. And what creates much of the discussion, that it also says the article, the data controller should take reasonable steps to remove any copies of this data or have them removed. We are working on ways to do that. You can have different ways of having sticky policies on data, or as most goes to search engines, there are people now working on a way to extend like instruments like robots.txt to give further instructions than just don't index, but be more precise on re-index every week or so. To data controllers. The other one, which is also a new idea, is the right to data portability, and that's the idea that if I have entrusted my personal data to one service provider and I want to change to another one, then they are obliged to give all my data back to me in a format that I can process. It says a generally used format. It doesn't say an open source standardized format, but one format that is generally used and could be useful to import the data with another service provider. Okay, I skipped that a bit. That's somewhat. There's also more explicit rules on information and communication, like how much information one should get. The principles of data protection by design and by default are coded in the law, making it clear that what is data protection by design? It basically means when a big new system or an app or whatever is developed, then privacy issues should be taken into account from the very beginning, and so that no one can argue at the end, yeah, say, well, the system is just built like that, I cannot do any better in data protection. Some found that this is already legal now. There was a decision by a court in Germany at the end of last year who told a data controller who didn't want to give a person her data because it was too much effort to find it. And the court says, well, that's not a good excuse. If you have to organize your data processing so that you can actually respond to such a request because it's her right, and if you are not well organized in that respect, it's your problem, but not the problem of the data subject, which is a good step forward, I think. Okay, What also will be new is a comprehensive obligation to notify data breaches. When someone has a breach and personal data is stolen, then they are actually obliged to inform at least the data protection authorities, and in cases where it's really bad, also the people that have been concerned. That's now in force for the telecommunications sector comprehensively in Europe and in Germany. In the German law, there is already an obligation for that, but at EU level, it's not yet everywhere. Okay, that's more technical. Well, transfer, supervision. I think this is all, well, this is a very interesting slide. Yeah, okay, it doesn't, it's not really important. So, and here is the, again, the state of play of the process. So the Commission proposal was adopted on 25 January 2012, and where we are now is the co-decision process by the European Parliament and the Council. Just to explain this, the European Parliament is a parliament with 700 members, which are directly elected in the now 28 member states. So on Monday, I think like seven or so new members from Croatia joined the parliament when Croatia became a member state. And the council is the assembly of the governments of the member states. And for something to become an EU law, meaning a regulation or directive, both the parliament and the council have to adopt it. And that means that they have to agree on a common text, which is then accepted by both houses. It's a bit like in Germany, we have two chambers in the parliament, the Bundesrat, which is the representation of the Länder, and the Bundestag, which is the directly elected general parliament. And so, but here it's not quite the same, but similar, even though the council is much more powerful at EU level. The council is the member state ministers, and they have to agree. And so, after the proposal was adopted last year, then it took a while until the discussion processes in both houses started properly to be discussed. In the council, it's always the presidency that is leading the debate, and that is always one of the member states is chairing all the meetings and preparing the agendas and deciding which documents come to the table and so on. That was Denmark first and then Cyprus. Denmark first half of last year, that didn't happen very much. Then Cyprus, which is one of the smallest countries, so they couldn't manage to do very much. And then it was Ireland for the first half of this year, and Ireland really pushed the discussion on the data protection things. They had like 20 meetings in the period, and so they really made some progress. And now the new presidency is Lithuania, where I don't know yet what their take is on data protection, how much energy what they will put into that. In the parliament, there's one member of the parliament who's chosen to steer the proposal through the legislative process. That's the so-called rapporteur, Berichterstatter, is it in German. The MEP, member of the European Parliament, in charge of that is Jan-Philipp Albrecht, who is from the German Greens. Some of you may have heard of him already or seen him or seen his contributions in discussions. He was the only politician from Brussels last Saturday who was able to give a statement on the new spying revelations. So he was on Tagesschau on that day. All the others needed more time. So, and the parliament's position on this on a legislative proposal is called the report, Bericht. It is called a report, and it's basically lists all the changes that the parliament wants to do to the draft provided by the commission. And he was nominated rapporteur in March 2012, and then started working, talking with people, with other parliamentarians and so on. And his report was ready in December and presented to the press on 10 January 2013. So that is his proposal for the discussions in the parliament. And then on that basis, the other members of the parliament and the other parliamentary groups state what they want to change in the commission proposal. And this goes first to the committees of the parliament, and then the final is the lead committee, which in this case is the Liebe committee. It's, or in German, it's the Innenausschuss of the European Parliament, Committee for Civil Liberties and Home Affairs. And this will make the final proposal, which then goes to the plenary of the parliament. That's where all members of the parliament decide on it and vote on it. And so on the basis of the report, there were four other committees which wanted also to have their voices heard on this proposal, and that were the Industry Committee, the Internal Market Committee, the Legal Committee, Juridical Affairs, and the Employment Committee. And the positions of the Employment and the Jury Committee were not so extensive, they were relatively short and focused on some things, but the opinions of the ITRE and the IMCO committee in particular created a lot of attention because they were, as some find, very much influenced by the strong lobbyism of, in particular, US-based companies. There is a website which is called lobbyplug.eu, which some of you may have heard of. They did a synopsis of 2,500 papers produced by lobbyists on this data protection reform. And many of these papers are not normally public. They are given to members of the parliament in private. But this time, some members of the parliament decided to cooperate with civil society and gave it to the people running this website. And they went through all this stuff and identified, and sometimes the lobby papers actually say, well, we from, well, not to name someone, from the banking association of country X, we think this sentence should be changed because it would be better for banks if this right would be dropped. And then there is an MEP who says, yeah, I like it, signs it, and hands it in as his proposal to change the law. And these people from LobbyPlug went through all these lobby papers and found which amendments, that's what these documents from the members are called, were inspired by which company. They didn't, they only did the most active companies like eBay and some Amazon, I think, some others, and found quite some members of the parliament that were kind of just handing in lots of lobby-inspired amendments and business lobby-inspired amendments. And the reports adopted in these committees, I think one can say, would, if they actually become law, weaken data protection considerably below the level that we have now. They play with everything. They make the definition of personal data more restrictive so that less data would become personal data and would fall out of the rules on data protection completely. And they would create plenty of exceptions for all kinds of business reasons. So nearly everything would be allowed. Some try to invent something which is so-called pseudonymous data, which basically means, well, if you take away the name and replace it by a number and put the name and the number in a different table or a different database, then the data is no longer personal and you can do with it whatever you want. So all very good ideas from a business perspective. And well, in the meantime, LobbyPlug have updated their website and they have done a second process. And they have gone through all the about 3,000 or 4,000 amendments which need to be discussed in the Liebe committee and have classified them in good, neutral or bad for data protection. I'm not necessarily sharing their assessment because I have not gone through everything that they have assessed, but it's quite obvious that there are good, bad, and technical amendments. So, and then they have classified, ranked the MEPs according to whether they have submitted good, bad, or neutral amendments in the lot. So that's also certainly something which not all MEPs are absolutely happy with. Okay, but it's quite interesting, and I think one should use one's own judgment to whether or not it's good. And so, of course, a complex thing, it's not that easy. One has to do a lot of reading. Well, anyway, the task of the rapporteur is to negotiate a compromise text with his colleagues as much as possible. Because if they would vote on 4,000 amendments, probably the vote would take about 2 days, and they couldn't do anything else during that period in the parliament. Hello. Yeah. So that's also a technical issue. But the vote has to be postponed until there is at least a number of useful compromise amendments, and the vote in the Libe committee was originally planned for April. Then it was found that that was too complex, and then it was postponed until May. And well, you see the story there. Then it was June; it didn't work either. Then the hope was that it would be July next week. That's the last possible week before the summer holidays, and now it's scheduled for September. And I would say your guess is as good as mine whether it will actually be in September or whether it will be further postponed. In the Council, as I said, the Irish presidency has spent a lot of energy in moving it forward. And the last high-level discussion was 6-7 June. There was a meeting of the actual ministers. Normally, the Council meets in groups of lower-level officials, but in this case it were the actual ministers, and they agreed that the text that the Irish presidency has produced on the basis of discussions on the chapters 1-4 of the regulation, and the regulation has 10 chapters or so, is a good basis for further discussion. It's diplomatic language. No? Diplomatic language sounds always positive. I mean, like, both sides agreed that they had a very interesting exchange of views. Well, that's basically, it says, that's all that we could agree on. We couldn't agree on anything in substance. And so saying, using this formula means don't have an agreement on the substance. Even this text on chapters 1-4, which is a good basis for further discussion, is only just the beginning of the real tough thing. So also the Council is very strictly fighting. Germany was not exactly the big defender of data protection rights, as you might expect, but had strong reservations against the use of a regulation in the first place and of applying the rules to the public sector. And there's plenty of areas where discussion is still ongoing. So we don't know exactly how, I don't know exactly at this point how the Lithuanian presidency will carry this forward. And the next big thing which is happening is the elections of the European Parliament in May 2014, which means basically that the election campaign will start around March or so, so that the time window for coming to an agreement in this process as it was intended is very short, which is not necessarily a disaster because the process can be interrupted for the elections and then restarted with the next European Parliament. So, but what happens also is that next year the term of the current commission ends and then a new commission will be installed by the new parliament, and that means, among others, that the commissioner who's sponsoring this bill and is pushing it and forward and pushing data protection forward, which is the Luxembourg Commissioner Vice President Reding, will also no longer be in that post, most likely, unless she is reappointed to that post, which has never happened, that someone gets reappointed to the same post in the Commission again. So it's very difficult, and it's to predict what's going to happen. But still, I would say the process needs to maintain public attention, because looking the other way and thinking, oh, well, some European rules, who cares, it's not a good idea, because something will come out of the process, and it will apply directly to all of us. And so we are all concerned, and we should all try to make sure that not the powers of business lobbies and so on determine the whole process. Yeah, I think my speaking time is about over. I don't know if the organizers allow. I have no problem to take questions. So, and we have a microphone here. So if any one of you has a question, I can bring around the microphone, and or you can also shout from where you are, and then I repeat the question so that they work for the recording. So, well, thank you for your attention from my part. These are the links, actually, and one thing, and here's the EDPS website, and also my personal Twitter thing. Oh yeah, and the hashtag for the whole thing is #EUDataP. I had it somewhere on a slide. That's also, when you follow Twitter, then you can also find what's happening. Now, over the summer break, not much is happening. You want to take some mic?
Thanks. On the right to be forgotten, is it a hard requirement to delete the data, or is it just to make it unavailable?
Well, the principle that already is in force at this moment is that anybody is only allowed to process personal data as long as there is a legal reason for that. And when this legal reason is gone, you should destroy the data. It also means, of course, when you are a bank and you are under the rule that you have to keep all transaction data in archive for 5 years, then that is a legal ground. But after the 5 years, you're not allowed to do it anymore. So it should actually be really destroyed in a safe way. I mean, there's always cases where someone throws away their paper archive, like a hospital or somewhere, just in the paper container across the street, and then some people find it and pick it up. This is also always cases where problems pick up. Now, that's already the existing right, okay? And what's new in the right to be forgotten is that you have to make sure that's no longer public, and when you have a way to get it out of the public domain, then you should do that as well. But that's more like doing reasonable steps. That's not a hard obligation to achieve a specific result. Yeah.
On the same issue, though, so I run a couple of websites that are involved in kind of government transparency. So that means I create archives of what politicians have been doing, and, for example, a list of everyone who's received subsidies from the farm policies of the European Union. Would you advocate that those be covered by the right to be forgotten, that we have to forget after 5 years what our politicians have voted?
No. That's a very good question, and that's a big concern. But journalistic and historical purposes and public interests are all good reasons to maintain the data. Yes. Well, the question was, the exception for journalistic purposes is appreciated, but who decides who is a journalist and what not? What about sites like WikiLeaks or the site StateWatch or LobbyPlug or whatever that are not necessarily journalists in the within the meaning of the word, that they're having a press card with them. That's a very good question, and that's actually a point where the language of the articles should be more precise and can be improved. One element in this is the balance between press freedom and data protection is also covered in a specific article in the proposal, and this article allows to the member states to define this more precisely, which may have a very good result in the end in most member states, but of course it's not fully satisfactory. Personally, I would agree that this is an issue which requires further elaboration. There is some merit in these arguments. Yeah.
Concerning about the right of forgotten, there is actually a Spanish citizen mm-hmm. who is the first person in Europe that asked, because 15 years ago happened something with him, and still today this is changing his life, his job, and he asked to the justice of his country to take out of internet this information, and in the country say we cannot, and this involved Google's, and he came up to the European Court of Justice, yep. and the European Court of Justice say Google is right, they cannot take out, and this is not still a justice decision, but it's the first case, and this concerns really what we are talking about the data. And this person today is a simple man. It's not a political noble. No, it's like anyone, and he's fighting against God.
Yeah, indeed, there is a case which is currently being discussed in the European Court of Justice. That is the highest judicial institution of the European Union, and there was a Spanish citizen information about something that went wrong in his life was public 20, 30 years ago, and when one puts his name into the search engine, then still information about this case turns up. And of course, I mean, this is something, this is really kind of the substance of the question of the right to be forgotten. Should someone who had some problems in his private or business life 30 years ago, still every time when someone checks his name in Google, should that all the time be repeated? That's the substance of the case. The court has not made a decision yet. The week before last, the Attorney General, that is kind of the expert lawyer of the court, gave his position, and he made it simple by saying, oh, well, the data protection law doesn't apply to search engines, so because it's not data processing. A position to which no European data protection authority agrees. All see it differently. Of course, the Spanish one who was involved in the case, but also ourselves, we say it's processing because it's data related to an individual identifiable. Why should it not be processing just because it's a search engine? And I mean, it's kept in cache, it's organized in big collections, even, and probably, I don't know, I mean, which percentage of search queries is actually with names in it. I mean, it's a considerable percentage, not only the so-called vanity searches, where someone searches for his or her own name, but also all kinds of I mean, you get it's standard practice that anyone who wants to employ someone looks on the web what they can find about this person. I mean, so it is part of personal data, but the court, the lawyers of the court, and the judges hopefully come to a reasonable conclusion, but the Attorney General, I think, got it wrong, but that's firstly the position that is in place. Yep. Just another position, just as we talk about it, in Germany there was also relevant court cases, and that were the murderers or the convicted murderers of the Bavarian actor Sedlmayr. That was also already 20 or so years ago. They were found guilty. They were convicted to lifelong imprisonment, which in Germany means something around 20 years or so. And they were released after having served that term. And then they found that in Spiegel archive, all information of their case with their name on it was still accessible. And so they asked that to be removed. And then they sued Spiegel, actually, even up to the Federal Court of Justice, the Bundesgerichtshof. And the Bundesgerichtshof then decided that they had not the right to demand that this information should be deleted from publicly accessible archives. The side effect of that was that, of course, their names were fresh in the press when reporting about this price again. But there are still court cases ongoing, also one which is going to probably, was in the European Court of Justice, because they also sued Austrian media in German courts, and there was the question which law would be applied, but this case, I think, is still not final. So it is a very sensitive issue indeed, this right to be forgotten. Okay, yeah.
You speak mostly about the effect of these laws upon corporate entities and, well, most corporate entities. If it's passed, will it have any power over governments? I mean, governments don't seem to give a hoot about the law anymore. They just do what they want. What kind of possible enforcement would there be if a government is, like, we have more revelations like the recent ones, mm-hmm. about PRISM, about GCHQ.
Yes.
In the future, will EU law, will anyone pay attention to it at a government level? And could that be why it's taking so long to get through as well? Because governments are thinking, do we want this passed?
Yeah. Well, by your accent, you were from the UK,
yes.
Are you? Actually, the data protection authorities also have supervision on the public sector in their countries. It includes government up to the highest level. So the German federal commissioners regularly having his fights with police authorities and so on, and also checking them and in the annual reports giving they are criticizing them on their processing behavior in some cases. In Germany it's quite common that they do it. The ICO, which is the Information Commissioner's Office, or the Information Commissioner, the Data Protection Authority on the UK, also supervises government authorities. They have had plenty of cases with local councils where the municipality level did something wrong with children data in schools, and cases with the National Health Service. Not aware so much on the government, but in principle, the supervisory authorities do have the power to go also into any ministry and say we want to see what's happening here, or into a police office and so on. It's very much a question of the culture and the political situation in each member state, how effective this is implemented. The regulation for the police side, as I mentioned, it's special because that's very much still national powers and not under EU control. And, there is also a supervision of what member states do in general by the EU Commission. I was myself in the Commission, and we had a case where we found that the UK was not applying some data protection rules correctly. And so we opened an infringement procedure against the UK, and in that case it was quite successful because they actually fixed the law rather than being taken to the court in Luxembourg and getting a judgment saying you are wrongdoing and have to pay or something. So it's not completely toothless, so sometimes it works. But the attention of the general public is, of course, a factor that also has an impact on what the authorities are doing, both those processing data and those supervising the others. There was one question behind, I think the gentleman with the... Can you pass it?
I feel that there's very much at stake here, because if the law will be bad, it will remove us of our data protection rights. So what can we do in order to get the politicians to come to a strong data protection law? Yeah. Would you encourage people here in this room to contact their members of parliament? Does it make sense?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm speaking here as an official of an authorities and not as a civil society or civil, well, I mean, as a political advocate. But there are, of course, civil rights groups at European level and also in Germany who are following this. I mentioned the website lobbyplug.eu, which also is connected. There is a campaign organized by an organization called European Digital Rights, EDRI, with a website edri.org, where also many German organizations are participating, like former Föbut, Digital Courage now, and I think the CCC is also, CCC is actually a member of EDRI as well. So there's quite a number of organizations that collect information and provide information and also provide activities where one can join, writing to members, so pointing out the issues and so on. So it is indeed possible to get involved in this. Yeah. Any further question? Well, thank you for your interest, and have a nice conference.